think there's a way in which the control offered by CBDCs is so egregious that there's no way to like sugarcoat it for populations. Like people do not trust it and they're not going to trust it. That said, most money, the vast majority of money that people transact with is already digital and it is already fully account-based. And so I think what CBDCs have done is in a way kind of exposed or begun exposing the extent to which the legacy financial system is already a system of control. And I think people feel kind of trapped, honestly. It's like the lobster that's been in the boiling water that's slowly being turned up hotter and hotter. Like, they don't know what to do about that. The great thing about technological innovation like Bitcoin is that regardless of what people are able to do about their local politicians or central banks, they can opt in and use Bitcoin. That is now available to 8 billion people, and that's going to change the world.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 866119, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Natalie Smolensky. Natalie is an anthropologist, executive director of the Texas Bitcoin Foundation, and a senior fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. She is also one of the people I look to the most for nuanced, thoughtful, and objective takes on Bitcoin and the chaos in the world around us to help me make sense of it all. We got into a lot of topics today, including Bitcoin as a cultural movement, modern information overload, the tension between the state and individual rights, decentralization versus centralization, the Constitution, free speech and censorship, peer-to-peer communication as a fundamental right, authoritarianism, totalitarianism, partisanship, the potential for individuals to affect change through using technology, and a whole lot more. We also discuss the Satoshi Papers, a scholarly effort by the Texas Bitcoin Foundation to reflect on the political economy in a Bitcoin world. And if you'd like to donate to the Texas Bitcoin Foundation to support all the incredible work they're doing, you can find the link in the show notes. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you're watching or listening. Give this show a boost on Fountain if you find it valuable. And if you're not listening on Fountain.fm, what the heck are you doing? You could be earning sats while listening to this show. Check out bitcoinpodcast.net for episodes and additional resources. Head to the show notes to grab links for my sponsor, Bitbox, and other partners. And send an email to hello@bitcoinpodcast.net if you have any feedback or if you're interested in sponsoring the Bitcoin Podcast. And don't forget to share the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin Talk with Natalie Smolensky. Natalie, welcome. Thanks for coming on the Bitcoin Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you, Walker.
I got to see you at a Bitcoiner wedding this last weekend, and it's always interesting coming back to normie land after that.
Yeah.
You're around Bitcoiners so much, sometimes you forget that a lot of the vast majority of the population does not, quote, get it yet. Mm-hmm. And we saw kind of some worlds colliding there at the wedding itself. You have this Bitcoin contingent and then the old friends contingent. I don't know. It's always it's a kind of surreal experience.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely. And, that's one of the wonderful things about, the Bitcoin movement is that it straddles all kinds of communities, whatever your cultural background, political beliefs, area of study, let's say focus, professional industry, like there's a part of the Bitcoin value proposition that's compelling for you.
Well, it's a beautiful thing, really, because I'm certainly not the first, nor will I be the last person to say this, but the idea of Bitcoin being a mirror and really reflecting some of your own worldview back at you. And I think that's a really powerful thing, because if you're, let's say, a political conservative, you can find a lot of conservative principles upheld in Bitcoin. This is a return to sound money, right? This is more of a limited government type mentality of separation of money and state. But by the same token, if you're progressive, okay, well, this is literally the separation of money and state. There's nothing more progressive possibly that there could be than that. And so I find that kind of beautiful. And as you said, it brings together quite a diverse crew of people, which I think is ultimately Bitcoin's strength, right? It's Bitcoin doesn't care who you are. You just have to find your way to it. But still we're at, I think, I don't know if you checked out that study that Troy Cross did about just what does the makeup of Bitcoiners in America look like? And as a result of that, he estimates somewhere around 7% of Americans own Bitcoin, you know, probably some margin of error there, but that was both higher than I thought it would be, but also that's still a tiny minority. You know, we're still early, quote.
Yeah, definitely. We're basically witnessing the monetization of a new, not just asset, but category of asset in real time. And so, I mean, if you think about how long it took for a commodity like gold to become monetized, I mean, that goes into like the dawn of human prehistory. And so, you know, it's extremely early, but the adoption is also happening much, much more quickly than other commodities in human history.
And you do have a ready example of that, even in just like ETF inflows as a Bitcoin proxy. Obviously, I would recommend people hold real Bitcoin, but for those that have money locked away in a 401k that hopefully the government won't decide to dip into later for whatever reason or change the rules about, that's a nice way to get exposure to Bitcoin. But those inflows have just been like historically massive. Clearly, I mean, the speed at which BlackRock changed its tune and Larry Fink changed his tune specifically about Bitcoin, the mind, it boggles. Like, it's incredible to kind of see that shift. And again, we're 15 years in. I've only been around for a few of those years so far, since like 2020. But even in that time, you've seen the narrative shift, the Overton window shift. It feels like when you have a presidential or multiple presidential candidates, I should say, talking favorably about Bitcoin, that's kind of a big moment. It feels like, and I know you're quite a student of history. And I mean, does this mark sort of the beginning? Is this like are we already in the Bitcoin era, I guess is the question. Did that start when Satoshi released the white paper and just that era is slowly building? Or are we seeing ourselves transition to this era now where Bitcoin becomes this household name that even if you don't own any, you certainly know about it. You can't ignore it. It's in the news every day. It's something that's just part of the common vernacular.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to say we are in the Bitcoin era. Future historians are going to need to date that era from some point, and the release of the white paper seems like as good a point as any. And there are, massive capital pools across the world that are looking for, a way to just preserve value in the face of rampant devaluation of fiat currencies. And so, I mean, they're literally looking at, fiat as a melting iceberg, and they need somewhere to park their capital. And, there's only so much real estate in the world. There's only so much, let's say, productive industry, only so many bonds that can be invested in. And so Bitcoin is kind of ideally suited to function as a store of value in an extremely volatile historical moment.
Volatile is a nice word for this present moment. I go back and forth on this because I think it's very tempting, and this is me speaking personally, it's very tempting for myself to say, wow, what an insane time we live in. Everything, it seems like, everything everywhere all at once is happening.
Yeah.
But then I have to think, well, is that also just my and all of our collective exposure to 24/7, 365 instantaneous news at our fingertips? Has history always been this chaotic? But of course, you weren't aware of what was happening on the other side of the planet because you were barely aware of what was happening in the next village over.
Right, right. No, I mean, with the acceleration of information and communication, you have acceleration of transformation and change, you know, in not just in formal institutions, like governing institutions, economic institutions, but also in things like social norms. And so the transformation of culture is happening at an accelerated pace. And there's no way to put that genie back in the bottle. I mean, we're living through what the French philosopher Paul Virilio called the information bomb. And that's a violent event. It's fundamentally disruptive for human civilization. And so the question for us is actually, you know, the British philosopher Alfred North Whitehead wrote in his essay on symbolism in 1927 that the civilization that innovates fundamentally disruptive technologies does not survive that innovation. So that technology, in effect, destroys the civilization that invented it. And so the question for us now is, can we survive the destructive implications of the information technologies that we've invented?
And in a, you know, perhaps at that time, given that there was less, let's say, for lack of a better word, like globalism, you know, in the 1920s, perception of what civilization meant may have been more geographically isolated versus now we are completely connected. There is, you know, access to this information everywhere. It's like, this is the global civilization. And are we going to, you know, eat ourselves from the inside out, essentially, which is sometimes it feels like that. I sure hope not. You know, I'm curious, because you've talked at, I think, great length and tweeted or posted. I'm not sure what Elon calls it now, honestly. I'm just going to keep calling it tweeted, though, because it feels right. But, you know, like in the same vein as this information bomb, this information overload, when there is so much information available, that is one thing that is very overwhelming, of course, for the individual. But then at the same time, you have companies and nation states that have made it their mission to digest, collect, and interpret as much of that information about individuals as they possibly can. And, you know, you had a great tweet. Maybe it was a couple of weeks ago, but it stuck with me. It was something to the effect of, like, without anonymity, everything becomes either crime or pre-crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was really interesting. And I wonder if you could kind of expand on that a little bit, because I don't think that most people are cognizant of the fact that there is a very slippery slope towards absolute, complete totalitarian surveillance at a level that was never before possible during other totalitarian regimes, because the information wasn't there. It wasn't digitized. It wasn't immediately available. There wasn't a metadata footprint tied to everything.
Yeah. No, I mean, so the first reaction of many when faced with significant and potentially existential problems is control. Control is the easiest thing to default to. It's the easiest thing to assume. It's very easy to get widespread support for it because it seems so intuitive. Well, the reason bad things are happening is because the right people don't have enough control over what is happening. This is part of, you know, our human mode of reasoning Some philosophers have called it the natural attitude. Just, you know, the day-to-day, we're just going through the world attitude. We tend to personify cause and effect. So, you know, if bad things happen, we look for someone, person generally, or group of people to be responsible for it. We have a really hard time with complexity, with, you know, especially counterintuitive or like nuanced causal mechanisms. And so the first step, again, when, you know, facing an existential crisis tends to be some form of argument for more authority, more control. It can feel fundamentally disempowering for people to hear that the thing that threatens them is scaled so far beyond anybody's ability to control that perhaps more like going down the social stack to more fundamental modes of relating is in fact where we have to begin. So things like individual relationships, you know, the family, the school, friendship, the things that we choose to do together with our pack, you know, startups, companies, projects that operate at a small scale. It's scaling that kind of cooperation that is, in fact, how we avoid the existential collapse that the information bomb threatens us with. But, you know, when you have institutions like state, which, regardless of scale, one of the characteristics of the state is that it has the power to indict. So the functioning of the law and the courts is the functioning of the apparatus of the state. And so all of the information that it can collect, it will collect. And it won't necessarily use it, at least not immediately, but it will hold it in reserve. And so the more information becomes public and available to the state, the bigger their arsenal for potentially coming after anyone for any reason. There's a fantastic lecture, it's available online from the late 90s, actually, a law professor, can't remember which university he was giving it, but he was giving this lecture to a law class. And basically it was an argument about why you should never talk to the police ever under any circumstances ever. And there's several reasons for that. One is because in the vast arsenal of law, you know, let's just say federal laws, there are like over 10,000 federal laws that you could potentially have broken. I mean, all of us likely can be accused of breaking one of those laws or more of those laws. And so not making yourself a target is the key way that you actually prevent that mechanism of indictment from functioning. And so the problem with, you know, information that's public is everything you say can and will be used against you. I mean, that is literally the Miranda warning that is read to people placed under arrest. And so we have this Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. And that protection can be summed up in the fact that you cannot be compelled to speak to the state. You cannot be compelled to produce information for the state. But if everything's public, then that information is already being produced. by you and about you. And so it all goes into the pre-crime database that can then be leveraged at any time by any representative of the state. That's very dangerous.
It's kind of terrifying because it seems that like the genie doesn't go back in the bottle, right?
No.
It's already out there. We're already past that. It's not like we can all of a sudden, let me pull in all of this, all the things I've said, all the data that's out there on me. So, is there a solution to this for the individual to protect themselves from the state? Or is this just sort of a situation where the only way is to kind of hope that you have enough laws in place that the state will respect for long enough that you won't get completely skewered by them for, you know, a meme you posted, for example, depending on, you know, where we're at in this cycle?
The solution is in the constitutional limits to the power of the state. So we already have a solution. It's the Constitution of the United States of America. The problem is that nobody respects the Constitution anymore. It's literally become almost an irrelevant document, in large part as a result of the assumptions that those inhabiting the three branches of government have brought to their role in stewarding that Constitution. So huge part of the problem is the legislature, is the American legislature has, in effect, engaged in a kind of game of political optics for centuries now, but it particularly accelerated in the 20th century and then in the second half of the 20th century. Their legislators treated constitutional rights as things that they could sort of carve up into hyper-specific statutory claims and then pass legislation that in effect overrode the Bill of Rights. So the you know, Right to Financial Privacy Act of 1978 is like this excellent case in point, because it was originally devised by a couple of congressmen who were outraged by the third party doctrine, in which the Supreme Court in 1976 argued that if you're using a third party to convey or custody information about yourself, you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. That third party is not obligated at all under the Constitution to protect your information, which in an information economy, as you can imagine, in effect did away with the Fourth Amendment. So there were a few congressmen who were like upset about this. They, you know, created this Right to Financial Privacy Act, which was an attempt to declare in statute something that was already in the Constitution. But of course, as they began elaborating the legislation, nobody wants to ever be seen as soft on crime or, you know, creating loopholes. And so they ended up carving out 20 substantial exceptions to the right to financial privacy that in effect enshrined in statute the complete lack of financial privacy for Americans. So this law ended up just like fully doing the opposite of what it set out to do. And it's just one example. We have a constitution, but those who have been charged with protecting and preserving the constitution have not done so. So it does not operate.
I'm chuckling to myself, not because of this is a good situation, but more so because it seems like every government law that really like gets it in there, sticks it to the people, it's named just the exact opposite of whatever it does. And it's like,
right,
they keep doing it and over again. And at this point, it's just almost funny. It's like, okay, what does the law really do? Well, let me just take the inverse of whatever the name of the law is, and that should give me a pretty clear path to determining what the actual function of that law is in reality.
Yeah. It's
ridiculous. I mean, it's literally just like upside down world. I don't know. It feels strange that we're at this place, but you know, the Constitution is an incredible document. And I think what always amazes me is the foresight that the founding fathers had. Like, yeah. They clearly realized that there were going to be people who would be in positions of power that would try to encroach on the rights of the people and to go against the will of the masses and do things, you know, that would be allegedly for the greater good or whatever other slogan you want to do. But as you said, we're at this place now where it seems like there's always a quote crisis or a set of bad actors that are used as an excuse to strip away the supposedly unalienable rights of the American people.
Right.
And America is still, I think, for all of its flaws, still one of the better places in the world that you could be. Like, it's still a wonderful country, but it's sad because if America starts to go down this path of stripping away the things that make America America, which is a strong constitution that protects the rights of individuals, well, then that's a slippery slope for the rest of the world, which is already treading on thin ice. And it makes you worry a little bit that, does anything stop this? Is the only defense against this perhaps then not at all at the, you know, we have the Constitution, but clearly it's being disregarded in all sorts of rights. And clever lawyers of the state can always figure out ways to say that, well, with this, you know, this new technology, we actually can do unlawful search and seizure because, you know, this founding fathers, you know, they didn't really specify this because, of course, it was 1776. They had no idea this would exist. But is the only protection against that just to arm yourself with information and with technologies that then protect those rights because nobody's going to protect them for you?
Right. So this is why the Second Amendment is so very important. I mean, the Second Amendment is a bedrock of liberty for the American people. And, you know, traditionally it's been interpreted as the right to bear, kinetic offensive weapons. But in a information economy and in a globalized world, I mean, that... the right to bear arms also means things like end-to-end encryption. So the ability to quote unquote go dark, as some of its opponents in the state like to say, that, you know, going dark is the base state of affairs. Like, that's the state not having visibility into your life was just the default before the information bomb. And so, you know, what the state has been trying to do is change the default. You are always on display. You're always on stage. You're always being watched. And the exception is when you get a moment of privacy. And, you know, that sounds kind of criminal. Why would you want that? And so it's the Second Amendment interpreted for a digital world that ends up being the bulwark of protection of individual rights. And like with all rights, they only matter if you exercise them. So they have to be exercised by the people. And a civil society that is fully aware of and exercising its rights does end up pushing back against the state. The state is always testing to see what it can get away with, how it can change the Overton window, how it can frame you up to use its language, to use its priorities, its point of view. So you just have to, as a private citizen, you have to reject it entirely. No, we don't trust you as a rule, not as individual people. You may be a fine person. It doesn't matter. The power you exercise, the office you inhabit, is on loan from me. You report to me. I'm your boss. And so there is a model of power in which it's the individual that is upstream from the state, not downstream from the state. And so that through, you know, the use of things like peer-to-peer technologies, end-to-end encryption, censorship-resistant technologies, that is how we exercise our Second Amendment in a digital age.
I think it's quite interesting too that the United States, the state, literally did try to classify end-to-end encryption as arms. Like that was the whole, it was Adam Back, right, who wore or printed t-shirts with, I'm forgetting what encryption algorithm on them, but, you know, to basically protest against the export of arms that they were saying was happening if you were, you know, making these encryption technologies available. I believe it was Adam Back. I could be mistaken on that, but I think your point is a good one, and especially important about the, like, these things don't matter unless you use them. Like, it's all well and good if, you know, they exist and you have them, but if you're not actively practicing and using them, well, then the point is kind of moot, right? None of this matters unless you use the technologies available to you.
Like, right.
That is the key point, right? And what I worry about is, you know, this is like the cypherpunks wrote code. That's, you know, cypherpunks write code. It's what they do. And so many of these incredible technologies have been available for a while, but if they're not accessible to the layman, to the normie, whatever you want to call them, they're not going to be widely used. Does it require some sort of critical mass of use for this to be an effective bulwark against the state's encroachment? Or is even a small pocket of people resisting through the use of these technologies enough? Like, is there like a watershed moment where enough people use it where the state is effectively neutered? Or does even a little bit help?
Yeah. I mean, like so many things, the answer to that question depends on what you're trying to achieve, at what scale and on what timeline. You know, the institutions of what we would call Enlightenment era liberalism, you know, were the fruits of thousands of years of human political contestation and thinking together and adversarially across, you know, more than a continent of geographical spread. And so from my point of view, the most important thing is that the tradition of individual liberty, the commitment to individual liberty, stays alive, you know. And we may be living through an era where, you know, there's a kind of dark ages in that respect, and, you know, popular consensus moves against it. The exercise of state power and capital moves against it, and so it may be up to a small group of committed people to keep the practice alive and build bottom up the commitment to using these technologies such that at some point in the future they achieve some kind of critical mass to break through, you know, at some scale. It may be of 1,000 people, it may be of 5,000 people, it may be of 1 million people. Like, we can't really predict in advance how these breakthroughs happen, but it is absolutely the case that a single principled and determined individual can change the course of history. And so, you know, it's not over. We got to keep going.
You gave a really incredible keynote at the Bitcoin Policy Summit. I think that was that earlier this year?
Yeah, that was 2024 in April. Wow. Yeah.
I don't know why it feels like a long time ago. I don't know. Time is moving in a strange fashion these days. But
yeah.
It was really outstanding. And I was telling you before this, that I've watched it several times over because it's a, and I'll link it in the show notes. It's a really outstanding and succinct breakdown of kind of what's at stake and the power that you have as individuals and the overreach of the state and the point that it's at. But one of the things you said in there was peer-to-peer is a human right. Can you talk about that a little bit? And just maybe the broader thesis of that keynote, and maybe just even how you came to deliver that. Cause I thought it was not very long, but it was extremely dense and very powerful.
That's right. Right. So rights are irreducible. The thing that differentiates a right from an achievement, let's say, or a privilege, is that it cannot be taken in any meaningful sense. The subject of the right is always able to exercise it. What does that mean also from an economic standpoint? Means rights are not subject to the law of scarcity. So my right to freely transact with you is not contingent in any way on, you know, me having achieved some level of material comfort or political status or economic power. So rights are not contingent on you're having achieved any level of economic means or social status or political privilege. They are a function of your being a person in the world. And so your exercise of agency, which includes the ability to talk to someone or to yourself, in your, you know, internal dialogue, or to keep your own counsel, to follow the dictates of your own conscience, none of that is contingent upon anyone else or anything else. And that's why it can be meaningfully called a right. And so when I say peer-to-peer is a right, I mean, all that means is that nobody can give me permission to communicate with or interface with anyone else. Like that is a sovereign prerogative of me as a human in this world. And so the third party doctrine is, from my point of view, the most insidious attempt to systematically undermine human rights that I can identify in the last 100 years. It is truly toxic and inimical to all forms of human organization. And that's why we have to insist that intermediary-less communication, peer-to-peer communication transaction, is a right.
If you want to take full advantage of the power that Bitcoin offers you by actually using it in a secure peer-to-peer way, go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker to get yourself 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. The Bitbox team is awesome and I'm super glad to have them as partners. They build secure, easy to use open source solutions to keep your Bitcoin safe. And not only is the Bitcoin in your Bitbox safe from totalitarian government confiscation, let's say, but Bitbox is also one of the only two hardware wallets to protect against the dark Skippy vulnerability. So if you have one, you're in luck. Plus, and I cannot emphasize this enough, but the Bitbox O2 is extremely easy to use. Whether you're brand new to Bitcoin and it's your very first time setting up a hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath, it is Bitcoin only, and again, it's fully open source. Head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. Don't trust me or Bitbox. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off the Bitbox O2, but you also help support this podcast. So thank you. It's kind of funny because you seem to see some of the some people crying democracy as an excuse to strip away the rights of individuals, that, you know, such and such is required in order to preserve democracy, or so-and-so is a danger to democracy, so thus they must be deplatformed, debanked, whatever it may be. Is this just always the way of things, where those in power are going to try to use whatever means and whatever, you know, the guise of hate speech, misinformation, disinformation being used as basically a tool to say, hey, we need to censor everyone? Is this just always the way of things, or are we in this unique time because of, again, this information bomb, because while we have more power as individuals because of technology, the state has those same powers and a lot more resources at its disposal, that resources that were not earned, but taken, of course. But like, is this a unique moment, or is this just the same cycle that repeats again and again, but with kind of different pieces on the chessboard at this point, different capabilities?
Yeah, well, authoritarian attempts to control speech and expression are as old as time itself. They're nothing new. The difference now is in the capacity, the technological capacity of the authoritarians. So they have means at their disposal that they didn't have even, you know, a generation ago. And so this is why the contest in power between the state and civil society is so important for the preservation of liberty. It literally creates, you know, what Acemoglu, back when he believed in liberty, called the narrow corridor of liberty. And that was an extremely important contribution to the literature of political economy. But, you know, just to use him as an example, that's not what the Nobel Committee decided to reward. They instead read his work, his other work on institutions, very politically, and in effect, through their politicized reading of Acemoglu and his contributors, you know, have argued that institutions fail when a certain level of inequality exists in a society. And so this is the problem, is that, you know, authoritarians will always use, you know, some public emergency, whether that is terrorism or wealth inequality or, you know, war or whatever, to manufacture consent for submission. And it just has to be, you just have to have enough people in that society who have a principled commitment to the priority of liberty over the demands of the state.
That's a really nice, it's a really nice turn of phrase. That's, you know, I hope that we still do. And my feeling is I don't have data to back this up, but anecdotally, it feels like more and more people are, quote, waking up, are becoming aware that perhaps the designs of the state are not, in fact, in their best interests as individuals, in their family's best interests, in their community's best interests. They're real, and I think for a lot of people, that was COVID and all of the reactions to that. That was kind of a wake up call that, hold on, maybe the state, you know, is in fact just made up of people that are completely fallible, just like I am. And maybe they make really dumb decisions sometimes, or worse, maybe it's not incompetence, maybe it is malice, but let's, you know, not explain with malice what can be attributed to incompetence. I go back and forth on that one quite a lot these days. But it does give me hope that more people are becoming aware that they are going to make their opinions known and that they are going to voice their dissatisfaction. Where I think, at least speaking from an American perspective, we may often get into trouble is we're tricked by the false dichotomy of two-party politics. We're tricked by the red and blue teams against each other. And so people will often excuse the behaviors of their own team that if they were being enacted by the other team, they would in no way excuse. But it's kind of like a, well, you know, we've got to let this go. We don't want to speak badly about our team. And I wonder if you've just thought about, is that kind of duopoly, that Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola democracy, you know, pick one, they're totally different. I'm a Coke guy myself. I just think it's better, but that's beside the point. But does that in a way give us a false sense of security that there is meaningful change that can happen politically, when in fact, a lot of that change needs to be done in parallel by individuals, as you said, making the conscious decision to use technology available to them, to make their voices heard, to use technologies like Bitcoin that allow them to have a money that is outside of the system. Are a lot of people getting tricked? Are they falling into an idea that they can save the system from within the system, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what party politics or partisanship, to use perhaps slightly older term, that's what it comes down to. I mean, it's often leveraging cosmetic differences to create a division, such that, you know, certain forms of organizing, coming to consensus, become effectively impossible. And so, you know, divide and conquer. It's the age-old strategy. And people conquer themselves. I mean, people self-own. Most human tragedy, in fact, I would suggest, is fully avoidable. It's just a result of, you know, bad thinking, bad incentives, situations that were not prevented. And then by the time, you know, people decided to do something about it, all of the options on the table were terrible. So of course you're going to have tragedy under those conditions. So, I mean, Adam Smith wrote about this, the dangers of partisanship. The founding fathers wrote about it. In fact, one of the reasons that George Washington decided to not run for a third term is because he felt that he wouldn't get a single vote from the anti-federalist side. That was kind of the partisan divide that was prevalent in his day. And so, you know, that is also data, though, about what can and cannot be done at a certain scale. And so if you can't come to consensus at the level of, you know, 330 million people, which is the size of America, then you got to get smaller. What is the scale at which you can come to consensus? And that is effectively the scale at which you can govern, to the extent that you can. So build from there.
Is that scale like Dunbar's number, realistically, or can we get a little bit bigger than that? Because I completely agree with you. And I think it's this idea of, we have kind of two trends happening in parallel right now. On the side of the massive megalithic state, you have a trend toward more centralization, more control, broader reach, more encroachment into every aspect of every little part of your life that there possibly can be. And then I see another parallel trend, which is at an individual level, a decisive movement towards more localism, towards community building, whether those communities be physical in the real world, location-based, or completely geographically distributed online. And I just wonder if there is, again, if there's too much inertia on the part of centralization for a decentralized movement to break that apart, simply because by its nature, a decentralized movement is going to be less organized. It's going to have less resources pooled. They may have more resources in total, but in terms of the amount that is directed towards a single objective, they're much more smaller. They're in pockets. And, or do those, can those parallel systems just coexist and eventually the state just kind of implodes through its own ineptitude?
Well, I mean, institutions function at the level they can, right? So, if we're talking about a government, for example, there's a huge difference between, say, a mechanism of decision making that has to do with voting, that is electoral, whether for representatives or particular policies, say via referendum or ballot initiatives. And there's a huge difference between that and, say, deliberation. The idea behind representative government was that deliberation on policy cannot possibly happen at the scale of the population itself, even in, the colonial era. I mean, there were just too many people in Boston. and so we were going to elect representatives who would deliberate on our behalf with representatives of, other people, other geographic locations. But that deliberative body was assumed to be small enough that it could affect meaningful debate, dissension, and ultimately result in a more just process or a more representative process, let's say, of making laws. The challenge that we've seen with representative government is that it's very easily captured by powerful interests who, then make it crystal clear that the interests that are to be represented are not the interests of the people who have pulled the electoral lever to put the representative in power, procedurally, but that meaningfully the representative will be negotiating for, advocating for the interests of, its big donors or political patrons or foreign governments, as the case may be. In effect, what we're seeing at various scales of American government is that representation is no longer functioning. The legislatures are not serving as deliberative bodies. Instead, there has been such a high degree of capture by interests, and then the incentives, for the representatives themselves to continue in their positions of power. So they circle the wagons, they pull up the ladder, and in effect, most policy is decided by a very small number of people, without deliberation or, with very minimal deliberation, and then forced on the people through almost kind of a hostage taking type of scenario where, everything gets bundled into bigger and bigger omnibus bills. And so the question for the legislative body becomes, do you want the government to keep functioning? Yes or no? And that's just like the nuclear option. Like every decision is the nuclear option, and there's no specificity whatsoever about the meaningful issues that affect the people. And so that, I would suggest, is an institutional breakdown. Like that is an institution that is no longer functioning. And the question is, can it be restored to its representative function? And the answer to that is not clear. I mean, that's literally what we, the people, have to work out.
It reminds me of another thing you said in that keynote, which, and paraphrasing here, but basically that the people who are in power are only there because of the consent of the governed. and we can in fact revoke that consent. But what does that actually mean in a modern context? Because I agree with that, and it sounds great. And again, I am all for revoking that consent. But is such a thing actually, like, you know, a vote of no confidence in the absolute megalith of the state? Like, is something like that even possible? Does it have to start? Like, where does that start if we are to go about revoking our consent? Can such a thing be actually done at the scale that the state is today?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't take on like the entire state at
it's
once.
A big state.
Yeah. So the question is, where do you start with revoking your consent? And you always start small. So what is the sphere of your most intimate level of consent? Well, that is the consent to have your communications and transactions monitored by a third party. So that's where we can start revoking consent for that. Like right now, anyone can do it. It's a battle. You have to fight for it, but you can do it. At the political level, there are mechanisms. You know, you can recall politicians. You can refuse to give them your vote. So that's pretty meaningful. You can also work to cut them off, cut their resource base off, support challengers. You can yourself, run for office, which is, you know, what I would suggest that a lot of people can do, especially at the local level. I mean, there are tons of local political offices that are just vacant because nobody runs for them. And so this is the problem is, you know, the local levels of participation have really dropped off. People, you know, are less invested arguably than any other time, you know, over the past century in like their local communities. And so that's where the power base of a representative democracy actually comes from. That's, you know, who elects people to represent them is that community. And so, you know, the answer to these questions about consent and participation are often not very sexy. I mean, they're like, hey, do you want responsibility? Like, do you want to do a whole bunch of boring stuff? Like, day in and day out and negotiate with people you may not like and, you know, try to come to consensus on issues that you disagree with others about, but that are actionable at, you know, a small enough level of social organization. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And then as that kind of participation strengthens, it forms a more and more meaningful bulwark against the overreach of higher levels of political organization.
I love that. And I was not trying to have a gotcha there because I very much agree with that sentiment. And I think that is what actually, I hope more people are coming around to, that what you do in your local community, the elected leaders in your local community, if that's where you're going to spend the rest of your life and raise a family, those elections matter to you as the individual a lot more than the presidential election does. And it's very, you know, who your local sheriff is, for example, like that matters at a meaningful level. Mm-hmm. And I think people have kind of dismissed that as, again, this trend towards more of a focus on the upper echelons of government has become come to the forefront. People have kind of forgotten that these things at a local level really do matter. And this was also at a state level, kind of the whole point of the United States was to have, like, it's the reason we're not just like the United States. Like there are multiple states here.
Right.
Like,
other,
but people seem to forget that. And I think I thank you for that reminder. And I want to switch gears a little bit here because I could pick your brain all day long and probably still not even come close to scratching the surface But I want to be conscious of your time, and I want to make sure that we do get to something that you brought up before this, which was the Satoshi papers that you work on. Can you give us the background on that, what the kind of goal is, what you're hoping to achieve with that?
Yeah. So the Satoshi papers is the name of a book that the Texas Bitcoin Foundation is publishing in partnership with the Bitcoin Policy Institute. And the purpose of the book was to get together interdisciplinary social scientists. So historians, philosophers, economists, anthropologists, to think through what are the implications for a denationalized peer-to-peer global digital currency like Bitcoin. Like, how does that change the relationship between state and society, and between the individual and society and state? And so this book is a collection of essays that they're scholarly, so peer-reviewed volume. It is designed to make headway in the academic community, which the social scientific community has until now been fairly hostile to Bitcoin. And one of the reasons is because there hasn't been a lot of good, citable academic work on Bitcoin. And that matters because, you know, academics are actually very important cultural actors. There's huge controversy now around the role of the university, the public role of the university, you know, how universities may or may not have contributed to, you know, certain culture wars or political battles. And, you know, the long and the short of it is that universities do have cultural power. Scholars do have cultural power. And so, you know, it's important to speak to the masses, but it's also important to speak to the intellectuals. And that's what this volume is doing.
Oh, I love it. And I mean, I saw that the Resistance Money crew were some of the contributors to that. And that's obviously,
yeah,
I think what they've done with the book with the same title is really outstanding. Because again, I think there's an easy knee-jerk reaction, and guilty of my knee-jerking in this case, to say, you know, okay, you know, screw these fiat academics, and you know, they're just captured, and they're, you know, run by this, you know, obviously inflated grant money that's all ultimately just coming from the printer, and it's all a symptom of this fiat disease. But okay, that can be true, but it can also be true that there is a lot of great work that has, can, and will come out of academic institutions. And the more that those institutions are sort of penetrated by this, you know, let's say, I don't want to say Bitcoin ethos, by Bitcoin as just sheerly existing, I think, and there being more awareness and more writing and research done about Bitcoin and its effect on society, I think that ultimately, you know, fix the money, fix the world, right? To sound very cliched. But so I think it's genuinely a wonderful thing that there are folks such as yourself, such as the Resistance Money crew, and many others who are focusing on this academic angle, because it does matter. And I think it was Rothbard talked about this a lot in Anatomy of a State, which was that idea that the academics are basically an intellectual bodyguard around the state. And this goes back long to before religion and state were separate. That was the church that was the intellectual bodyguard. And so, I mean, is that kind of what you see as the larger goal of this, to basically infiltrate? Sounds a bit too war, you know, like too much of a war, but is the goal to infiltrate, for lack of a better word, that intellectual bodyguard and to infuse it with the ethos that it kind of surrounds Bitcoin? Is that what you kind of see this going toward?
Yeah. I mean, imagine if we had a university system that was a principled guardian of individual liberties. Like, regardless of what else you believe, you can count on the faculty and governance of universities in the United States of America to always stand on the side of free expression, free transaction, bottom-up organization of human societies. I mean, that would be quite powerful. And so that's, you know, that's the revolution that we're trying to bring about is, you know, that I think a lot of people in the academy have been trained in a tradition that starts out with a liberative or emancipatory desire, but that quickly veers into, you know, the mechanism of emancipation isn't in fact the state and must always be the state. And so capture of the state needs to be our ultimate political objective. That inclination is toxic, not just to the functioning of our political institutions, but our culture. And so that conversation has to begin somewhere. And I don't necessarily believe that, you know, within my lifetime, there's going to be huge changes there, because it really takes time to reform institutions, especially, you know, institutions like the church. I mean, this is, the university system is a feudal form of social organization. It literally was a church, birthed in the institutional structures of the church. And so it's actually extraordinarily successful and resilient from just a survival standpoint, but it's extremely conservative. It's extremely slow moving. And there has been a consensus now formed in the priests of, you know, of social science that there are, you know, certain political objectives like wealth equality, whatever that may be, that, and, you know, climate preservation, you know, these issues that require the direct and very heavy-handed intervention of the state. And so that consensus, you know, needs to be eroded by being challenged by people who, you know, can't just be brushed off, like can't just be dismissed as propagandists or, you know, politicians or whatever. I mean, there has to actually be scientific work done.
I have a slightly related question to that, just because you mentioned culture. This is something I've asked a few people, and I'm still mulling around the idea myself. But if I were to ask you what is upstream and what is downstream of what, so where do you think the following lie? Technology, money, culture, and law. How would you arrange that hierarchy?
Yeah, you know, I think some of those terms are, they shouldn't be imagined as part of a hierarchy. They coexist. So, you know, technology is just the solution to a problem that becomes institutionalized. And that institutionalization can happen materially. Like you can actually create objects that are material, reproducible, that solve specific problems. That is, you know, what we think of when we think of hammers and nails. But it's also what money is. Money is a social technology, and it's also material technology. And so it's just a kind of technology. I mean, it's a subset of it. So, you know, there's no hierarchical relationship there. We're just talking about categories. Law is a type of social technology as well, but it's not the same thing as a norm, right? And so, like, you know, social norms are actually much more fundamental than laws. Laws are downstream from norms because they're a lot more precise. Laws are, that is, and they carry the penalties of social violence if they are very specific types of codified social violence if they are violated. Norms are much more diffuse. You know, if you do something socially awkward, non-normative, you know, some people may leave the room. They, you know, may not want to be your friend anymore. They may be mad at you, but they're not, you know, you're not necessarily going to go to jail or have your property confiscated or, you know, be declared an enemy of the state. And so, you know, one of the symptoms of our current era is that I think more and more people, at least in the politically active spheres, have been sort of calling to collapse norms into laws and to, you know, proliferate laws and to suggest that law is, in fact, the solution to, you know, the collapse of norms around things like fairness, cooperation, you know, even etiquette, like what words to use in public, how to speak to other people, what does respect mean? I mean, these are things that are highly contingent, that differ widely from community to community. The attempt to kind of force all of these things into the realm of law is a totalitarian move for that reason, because it's collapsing the distinction between laws and norms.
That is the best answer that I've heard to that question yet. So thank you for that. And I appreciate that you rejected the premise of separating money and technology, because I agree with that as well. So I thank you for that answer. That was that was excellent. And I apologize for the slight divergence, but you mentioned culture and it got in my brain. So I wanted to ask it, but I do want to get back to the Satoshi papers a little bit. Cause one of the questions that you had put as I was reading through the website, that might be taken up by this is it's the very first question, actually, what is an optimal form of government, for whom, at what scale, why, and what role does Bitcoin play in that form of government? And it goes alongside a question I wanted to ask you about, just kind of what is, I guess, what is the optimal, or what is the modern role of the state? What should it be versus kind of what it actually is right now?
Yeah. That is not a question that can be answered in any essential or absolute way. The optimal form of government has to be worked out by the constituents who are self-governing, who are governing themselves together. And so it will look very different in, a city in Thailand versus Sierra Leone versus, Chicago. Some of these questions in the Satoshi papers, call for papers, were not designed to produce like absolute answers, but to begin to describe methods by which people can approach those answers together. And so, you know, from my point of view, part of the answer to that question for America is that we do have a tradition of liberty here. So different political communities choose to embody different values. And there are tons of values, you know, to choose from, but you can't solve for all of them equally. The question becomes, as a community, which of those values are you going to prioritize? Are you going to put above other values? In the United States, I think, liberty was at the very top of that list. This is a community that is organized around the preservation of individual liberty. Not everyone's going to like that. And not everyone's going to agree with that. And that's great. There are tons of other jurisdictions that you can choose from with forms of government that privilege other things. But here, that's what we're going to commit to as Americans. And I think it's important to just say that and then see who opts in to the American project, because it's the people who raise their hands who are the people you have to work with. Like that then becomes your political community. And the question is, what can you do together?
Do you think that Bitcoin is at a fundamental level aligned with the American idea as it is laid out in the Constitution with regard to individual liberty above all else?
Yes, absolutely. No, I think Bitcoin is fully aligned with that and should be embraced by anyone who believes in the American project.
It seems, I think it might have been Alex Gladstein who said it's like the people that really hate Bitcoin are dictators and authoritarians. Yeah. And
right.
Rightly so. Like if you're an individual, there's no reason for you to hate Bitcoin, but I get why you would hate it if you're a dictator.
And yeah.
I think that's kind of, it's a little bit tongue in cheek, but it's absolutely the truth. And I think it seems to me that Bitcoin can be a great litmus test for, totalitarian temptation, use the words of Jean-François Revel. It is, again, a mirror. Like, it's going to show you, or how you react to it says a lot about who you are and what you believe. And, I mean, I'm curious now that Bitcoin is, it's a genie that is out of the bottle. It's no one's shutting it down. As long as it remains decentralized and secure, it will continue. It will, it's just going to TikTok next block, keep on going. Does this represent just that invention of Bitcoin or discovery, however you'd like to put it? Is that a fundamental change, a fundamental paradigm shift that it's a 0-to-1 moment that we cannot go back from? And that do you think that is the technology that has given us the greatest chance at a future that preserves individual liberty?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. One of the things that one of my co-authors and I write about in the introduction to the Satoshi papers is that there are these moments when technological innovation in a society sediments a new kind of knowledge that becomes a new common sense that people can't deny anymore. They can't say they didn't know. They can't pretend to be naive to it. And so whether they reject it or not, whether they like it or not, their fundamental presuppositions have changed. And so this is what, akin to what Thomas Kuhn called a paradigm shift. But that terminology is overused and not specific enough, I think, necessarily. The point is that we now know how to create a denationalized, censorship-resistant, peer-to-peer digital currency. It's open source. Code is open source. Everybody knows how to do it. It's been sedimented. The use of the currency and the digital ledger are going through a process of inexorable exponential adoption. And so there is no going back. There is no putting the genie back in the bottle. And now every government in the world gets to reform itself in light of that knowledge. This is why we're seeing CBDCs, for example. I mean, CBDCs are a direct response to Bitcoin. Their governments, in effect saying, we're going to produce something that that's better. And then we're going to force people to use it. We're going to use the power of law to destroy a money that is auto-metallic, as you know, some economists have called it. It's autogenetic. It is arising of its own accord, in direct contradistinction to the Chartalist theory of money. And so you're literally watching the state try to play its card, the law card, to kill a form of money that exists without reference to law. And so that is going to change the common sense of the society.
I mean, it's at a fundamental level, one could make the argument that Bitcoin is anarchy. And I mean that not in the, of course, the, you know, Mad Max version of anarchy that most people think of when they hear the word, but in the actual meaning of it, which is, you know, without kings, right? Or without rulers. Because
right.
Bitcoin is literally rules without rulers. And I'm very grateful that it exists. And I find it fascinating, as you said, this very obvious reaction to Bitcoin from the central bankers in the, you know, creation of CBDCs. And, you know, oh, how convenient, won't it be so convenient for you? And look what your, you know, benevolent central bankers have done for you. How kind of us. Yeah. But like you see also, I think one thing that actually pleasantly surprised me was not just within the Bitcoin community of people who are hyper focused on these sorts of things, but in a much larger, like the Overton window around CBDCs, like has included CBDCs for a while now, actually. Like people have been fairly aware of this and very vehemently rejecting this as, like, you know, maybe they don't understand all the technical ins and outs, but they have this feeling like, hey, I see what you're doing here and I don't like it one bit. Was that has that been your experience or watching this happen as well? Like, was it a little bit surprising to see kind of the almost like gut reaction, like visceral reaction of people really coming out against CBDCs? You have the eNaira as an example of people just refused to use it, right? They were just like, no, we're not doing this. Like, did that surprise you at all? Or do you think it's such an obviously totalitarian tool that people just, like, they just sniffed it out?
I think there's a way in which the control offered by CBDCs is so egregious that there's no way to, like, sugarcoat it for populations. Like, people do not trust it, and they're not going to trust it. That said, you know, most money, the vast majority of money that people transact with is already digital, and it is already fully account-based. And so I think, you know, what CBDCs have done is in a way kind of exposed or begun exposing the extent to which the legacy financial system is already a system of control. I think people feel, you know, kind of trapped, honestly, because they're, you know, it's like the lobster that's been in the boiling water that's slowly being turned up hotter and hotter. Like, they don't know what to do about that. You know, the great thing about technological innovation like Bitcoin is that, you know, regardless of what people are able to do about their local politicians or central banks, they can opt in and use Bitcoin. That is now available to 8 billion people. And that's going to change the world.
Amen. Natalie, I want to be conscious of your scarce time here. But I realized I didn't actually get a chance to just ask you who you are and how you got here today to be as knowledgeable as you are, to be working on all these things. What was your journey here? We'll end with the beginning, I guess. How did you get here to be doing all of these things?
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up in Texas. My parents were both software engineers, actually. So you know, grew up in this kind of ambient environment of technology and industry. I had very strong scientific inclinations, social scientific inclinations. So I went to school for anthropology and history, and, you know, other disciplines as well. It's, you know, let's say philosophy, psychology, economics. So I was interested in becoming a social scientist. But the American Academy is, as we were talking about before, I mean, it's broken. It's institutionally broken. It's culturally broken. It was quite possibly the most toxic social atmosphere I've ever been in. And it was not organized around the search for truth. And so I basically ended up deciding that I would have more freedom to actually pursue the project that I was passionate about outside of the academy. And so I ended up going into industry, you know, software. I'm not an engineer, so I went in on the side of sales, business development, services, worked at a couple of startups, and one of those startups ended up using Bitcoin to basically anchor digital claims. So how do you verify, you know, information on the web? It's very hard to do, but we developed a way to, in effect, digitally sign claims, anchor those claims to Bitcoin, and then validate the authenticity of those claims in the future indefinitely. So what we call today the verifiable credentials standard was incubated by a startup that I co-founded. And that was kind of the beginning of my interest in Bitcoin specifically as a technology for self-sovereignty, so digital self-sovereignty in a world where everything is intermediated by a platform. How does the individual recuperate any sphere of privacy and autonomy virtually? Bitcoin ended up being a key part of the answer to that question. So that company, you know, we built a SaaS product that enabled people to use our technology very easily issue these verifiable digital claims. We sold it to governments around the world, universities, including MIT, for example. So like to this day, if you graduate from MIT, you get a diploma, a digital diploma anchored to Bitcoin. My company built that. We sold that company in 2020 to an enterprise software company. So, you know, I've continued my life in industry as I've pursued my independent scholarly interests.
I did not know that about the company you co-founded. So is it similar to an open timestamps type of timestamping on Bitcoin then?
Yeah. So we actually used open timestamps in at one point in the early stages of our development. You know, we worked with Peter Todd on it. We've worked with a lot of leading lights in open source technology development.
I could probably do a whole episode with you just on that, but we'll have to save that for a different day. But Natalie, I really want to thank you for your time. I very much enjoy following you and listening to you speak, because I think that you are an incredibly reasoned voice in this space who approaches things very objectively and also appreciates nuance. So I want to thank you for that. Where do you want to send people? I know if they want to check out, it's satoshipapers.org. If they want to check out the Satoshi Papers, I'll link your X and your Nostr as well. Although I don't know if I've seen you as active on Nostr recently, but is there anywhere else you want to send people?
Yeah. So, you know, we're getting toward the end of the year, and the Texas Bitcoin Foundation, which is the 501c3 charity that I founded to do the research in the Satoshi papers. We are looking for donations, you know, beginning to plan our next year. We would love it if the community would consider making a contribution. You can donate in U.S. dollars or Bitcoin at txbitcoinfoundation.org. You can also just Google Texas Bitcoin Foundation; it'll come up. But you know, we truly do this as a labor of love. You know, we don't get paid. This is something we're doing like for the community and for the world. And you know, of course, as a charity, every cent you give us, you don't have to give to the war machine. So we greatly appreciate it.
I'll link that website in the show notes as well. And yeah, so donate to the Texas Bitcoin Foundation and stop funding so much war, I think is a pretty nice pitch there. But Natalie, thank you again for your time. This is really a treat. And yeah, looking forward to seeing you in person, hopefully again soon.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Walker. I really appreciate it.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of The Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring The Bitcoin Podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor or send an email to hello@bitcoinpodcast.net. If you are enjoying The Bitcoin Podcast and find it valuable, give it a boost on Fountain, a 5-star review wherever you're listening, or better yet, share this show with your network so more people can learn about Bitcoin. Or don't. Bitcoin doesn't care, but I sure do appreciate it. You can grab links in the show notes to watch or list this show wherever you get your podcasts, or go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast. And you'll also find the links to follow me and the show on Noster and on X. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million. But Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to The Bitcoin Podcast. Until next time, stay free.